In March of 1945, Allied troops crossed the Rhine River into Germany, into the inner territory of the Third Reich, and this represented the final phase of World War II in Europe. And one of the realities that the Allied troops encountered in the spring of 1945 was concentration camps. And perhaps the most famous of all the concentration camps was Auschwitz. But of course, Auschwitz was in Poland and was captured by the Soviet Union, not by the Western powers. But Auschwitz was not alone. And in April of 1945, Allied forces liberated camps at Dachau and Buchenwald, along with a dozen other smaller sites. In May of 1945, the United States 82nd Airborne liberated the small satellite camp of Neuengamme, called Wubelin, where they discovered 4,000 prisoners in dire starving conditions, plus many dead bodies, of course. And that scene is depicted in the TV series Band of Brothers. I don't know if you're familiar with that series at all. Yeah, one of the most brilliant forms of television that I've seen. And I want to show you that scene, just part of that scene where they liberate the camp. And I realize that not all of you are, some people are more sensitive to other things, so if you need to turn away, do it. But I don't think it's that bad, but it's not bad for me. I don't know for you. So let's just watch that scene there.
Caleb, what's this?
What?
Frank, what is it?
I don't know, sir.
Hey.
Stand back. Give us some room here. Stand back. Back. Back.
Yes, sir.
Leave God! Major needs you up front, right now.
Sure.
All right, boys. These people need care. Give them water and any spare rations you might have. Grab me some blankets, quick.
Sure. Oh, my God. Dick?
When news of the German concentration camps came to the the attention of Dwight Eisenhower, who was the Allied Supreme Commander. He ordered that extensive filming of these facilities be taken because he was convinced that the horror of the Holocaust was so overwhelming, the human depravity so complete, that voices would eventually rise up that would deny it ever happened or minimize its impact. Eisenhower had a prophetic sense about this. He wanted to make sure that the evidence was so thorough and so complete that it could not be denied in years to come. And as an aside, Canadian forces were involved in the liberation of the concentration camp at Westerbork in the Netherlands in April of 1945. Westerbork was a transit camp for Dutch Jews. It was more a transit camp than a true concentration camp. Yet when the Canadians arrived there, they found 876 inmates. Probably the most famous person who ever resided at Westerbork was Anne Frank. Anne Frank was ultimately transferred to Auschwitz and then finally to Bergen-Belsen, where she met her death. But she first started at Westerbork, a camp that the Canadians themselves had liberated. When something is so horrific and so awful that it completely strains our human sensibilities to the very limit, something like the Holocaust, where 10 million people were exterminated, including 6 million Jews, it's tempting at some point to mitigate its effect or impact by rationalizing or explaining it away. Because it really is, when you think about it, too hard to take in. You know, watching that in a TV show, it only gives a small glimpse of what was really going on. And so we see people who claim the Holocaust today was a complete fabrication, that it never happened, that it was a conspiracy to shame the German people. And we also have others who say the Holocaust was grossly exaggerated. Not 10 million people were killed, but perhaps 300,000 people died. So it's not as bad as they say. But if that were true, the Holocaust would still represent one of the great genocides of all time. You know, I want to just put a little plug in. As a libertarian, I do not think that we should be criminalizing this kind of speech as hate speech. To deny the Holocaust or to minimize it is historical malpractice. And the proper way to combat this malpractice is not to criminalize these claims, but to produce better informed citizens. And I think the real issue at play is the seriousness in which we take the historical story in our culture today, how we teach it in our schools. What is the evidence for the Holocaust? Do you know what the hard evidence for the Holocaust is? Now, we have enormous amounts of documentation, German documentation, related to the Holocaust. And we have, of course, the artifacts of the Holocaust, the former concentration camps that have been turned into museums, for instance. But the most important way we know about the reality of the Holocaust is the firsthand testimony about the concentration camps from those who lived through it and those who were involved in its liberation at the very end of the war. Let me give you an example, another short video, under a minute. Again, if it's a little bit challenging, if you can't see it, turn your head away, okay? Understand. This is a video clip filmed at Bergen-Belsen on April 23rd, 1945. This is about 8 days after the camp was taken by the Allies. 8 days after the camp was liberated by British and Canadian soldiers. This is the very camp where Anne Frank died, only about a month earlier. So let's take a look at this. The speaker, the speaker is the Reverend T.J. Sletch. He is padre of one of the British units that liberated Bergen-Belsen, and he lays out his credentials. Listen to what he says.
Reverend T.J. Sletch.
Really crank it up there.
Attached as padre to the formation controlling this camp. My home is at Fishguard. My parish was at Holy Trinity Church, Aberystwyth. I've been here 8 days, and never in my life have I seen such damnable ghastliness. This morning we buried over 5,000 bodies. We don't know who they are. Behind me you can see a pit which will contain another 5,000. There are two others like it in preparation. All these deaths have been caused by systematic starvation and typhus and disease, which have been spread because of the treatment meted out to these poor people by their SS guards and their SS chief.
It's not easy to hear. I had to listen to it several times, but the scene sort of depicts what's going on there. He describes the experience. Well, first of all, he tells us who he is, right? He's the Reverend T.J. Fletch. He lays out his credentials. His hometown is Fishguard in Wales. That's a real place. He's a priest at a local church named Holy Trinity, but he's on duty serving in the British military as a padre, as a chaplain. And then he begins to describe his experiences. Did you notice the horrific scene behind him, that pit, about 20% full of bodies that will eventually and quickly be full of dead bodies? And there are four pits like this at Bergen-Belsen of unknown bodies of unknown bodies to be disposed of. And he says, never in my life have I seen such damnable ghastliness. What a beautiful British understatement. Do you believe him? Like, he's up there. My question, do you believe him when he's telling you this? When you see this kind of video, do you believe what he's saying to you? When he talks about Bergen-Belsen, do you believe what he's narrating in this short video? Because you don't know him. You don't know him. You don't know what his character's like. Sure, there's a video of him speaking. There's a pit behind him, but the camera doesn't pan around the camp at all. We don't get to see the whole picture going on behind him. And we know videos can be doctored. Maybe even back in 45, they could be doctored. But with that knowledge, do you believe what he's saying to you? And more importantly, do you know why you believe him? If you do, I believe him. Why? Well, the answer is partly based on his credentials. He's a clergyman, and he was probably chosen for that very reason to speak to the camera. He's from a real place. He's from a real church community. He's a real person. That's worth something to me. And as a padre in the military, he's a fairly low-level officer. He's probably not clued into the political movements of his time. He's just an everyday guy like you and me sharing what he's seen. That makes his testimony more credible to me. And he says he's been at Bergen-Belsen for 8 days. That means he's had a chance to really look around and see what's going on in that concentration camp. He's looked at it all. He's seen everything firsthand. And this is not a partial assessment he's given to us. And it's not just a gut reaction right at the beginning of his experience. This is an informed opinion from Reverend Sletch of what he saw. And there's a certain understatement in his approach. He's not grandstanding. He's not doing this to gain attention. It's another reason why I trust what he says. I also trust Reverend Sletch's testimony in the video because he has no reason to lie to us or misinform us or deceive us. What would be his advantage to deceiving us about what he's sharing with us today about those German concentration camps? And the German concentration camps at large, they seem so far out that no one could have really seriously concocted a story like this unless it had really happened. This is so extreme, so outside our normal experience. Unless it really happened, there isn't really a historical analogy for what Reverend Sletch encountered at Bergen-Belsen. Now, understand that any historical event comes to us primarily through firsthand testimony from people like Reverend Sletch. We get to see the world at the time at that time and at that place through their eyes, through their testimony. And even though that world has disappeared, the world of 1945 in northern Germany has disappeared, and we can't touch it directly anymore. We can still experience it through the testimony of those who share their witness with us. Reverend Sletch himself is long gone. He's died. He's long gone, but his testimony endures. Now, in the case of the Holocaust, this kind of evidence is ubiquitous. I mean, it's everywhere. We just don't want to see it. We don't want to look at it. We don't want to touch it. We don't want to be connected in any way at all. Can you imagine watching an hour-long documentary on the Holocaust, a graphic documentary on the Holocaust, one that shows you what really happened in those camps? Can you imagine watching that kind of documentary for an hour? Neither can I. It's probably too hard to watch, really. But when we ignore primary information, when we don't avail ourselves of firsthand testimony, both in word and in picture, video, to the things that we'd rather not know, that makes us more vulnerable to misinformation. The New Testament is primarily a collection of firsthand testimony about Jesus. That's what the Bible is. So the New Testament, because the New Testament is only part of the Bible. It's primarily a collection of firsthand testimony about Jesus, about those first disciples and their encounter with Jesus, both in his life, through his death, and to his resurrection. And in its own unique way, the New Testament asserts something that is as shocking as the Holocaust. It strains our human sensibilities to its limits. Even though the ultimate claim from the New Testament is one of joy, not desolation, it's one of life and not death, it strains our sensibilities. It seems incredulous to so many, and it's often explained away and denied by others. Now, a major difference, of course, between the two is that everything related to the Holocaust falls within natural processes: death, torture, hatred, bigotry. These are things that we can understand, even if the Holocaust is on a scale that's hard for us to truly fathom. In fact, I would say it's impossible for us to truly fathom, but the undercurrents of it, something that we can identify with. We understand death, torture, hatred, and bigotry in some basic way. In the resurrection of Jesus, we are dealing with something that goes beyond natural processes into the realm of the miraculous, of the supernatural. But the Holocaust and the resurrection of Jesus Christ are both historical events. Between 1942 and 1945, Nazi Germany attempted to exterminate every Jew in Europe. And on the face of it, this is an outrageous claim. How could any government try to exterminate a whole race of people? It seems impossible to us. And our primary understanding of this historical claim rests on the firsthand testimony of a variety of people like Reverend Sletch. The artifacts of the Holocaust, you know, the factories, the crematoriums, all the documentation that with it, they're important. But if we did not have the firsthand testimony of people who had experienced the camps, endured the camps, who had liberated the camps, we wouldn't believe it today. We would not believe it. It would be too far removed from our normal experiences, and the artifacts could ultimately be explained away. But when you have people like Reverend Sletch sharing their firsthand experiences, I think that cinches the deal for us. At least it does for me. It's this kind of evidence that is critical in our embrace of the past. We have voices that we can trust. Sometime at the front end of the fourth decade of the first century, between 30 and 33, a Jewish rabbi named Jesus of Nazareth was crucified by Roman authority as a messianic pretender. And his disciples, against all expectations, quickly came to believe and proclaim that he had been bodily raised from the dead. This is a historical claim. And we face the same kind of challenge in adjudicating this historical claim as we do with something like the Holocaust. The artifacts might be important if we could find them, but what we need most of all is firsthand testimony that we can trust. And it's not surprising that while the story of Jesus' resurrection is being told, counter-stories begin to circulate in the population as well. Stories like Jesus' disciples stealing his body from the tomb. But remember, the claim of Jesus' followers is colossal. It's staggering in its size. It strains our sensibilities. Those first disciples say that Jesus was raised from the dead by God. Of course, there's going to be counter stories in the community circulating at the same time. If you can't accept what those first disciples are proclaiming on principle, then you have to come up with a reason or a counter story to explain it. You need to come up with another story to explain what they are actually saying to the world, to explain what had happened. What makes this so interesting to me is that pretty much everyone in Jerusalem would have known where Jesus' tomb was located. It would have been common knowledge in those citizens of Jerusalem. in the days and weeks after his crucifixion to know where Jesus had been buried. Everybody knew that, where he had been buried. And the question arises, why didn't the Jewish authority simply produce the body of Jesus in response to this outlandish claim being made by his first disciples? Why didn't they just produce the body? Because that would have put an end to it. Produce the body and Christianity is over. Produce the body and we all go home. Now, admittedly, Jesus' body would have rotted away in the tomb after a month or so and would have been unrecognizable. But still, why not produce the bones? Why didn't the Jewish authorities produce the bones? Put them on display for everyone to see. Here are the bones of Jesus of Nazareth, so-called Messiah. But we know from the sources, the Jewish sources at this time, that the Jews never contested the empty tomb. From the very beginning, they acknowledged the reality of the empty tomb. Everyone took for granted that Jesus' tomb was empty, which in simple terms means they didn't have the body, so they couldn't produce it. Why didn't the authorities have the body of Jesus? Because a follower of Jesus went to Pilate and asked for it. And once Pilate was satisfied that Jesus had died, well, why not? You can have the body. What's the big deal going on here? Now, it's true that in crucifixion, most of the time, bodies were taken down and tossed into common graves, but in Judea, a concession had been given to the Jews that they could, at times, bury the dead who had been crucified. And no one anticipated anyone making a claim of being raised from the dead. It wasn't even on Pilate's horizon at all. He never thought about that. Neither did the Jewish authorities. How could they have anticipated that claim arising? And what we see in Matthew today, what Naomi read, was only one example of the skeptical explanations about the resurrection of Jesus. There are many out there. They've circulated for the last 2,000 years. There's the swoon theory that Jesus wasn't really dead on the cross. He had fallen into a deep coma and then been revived in the cool, damp atmosphere of the tomb. And there's the hallucination theory, of course, that a group of disciples in their grief had hallucinated Jesus' return. As I say, there are many kinds of these theories out there. They circulate through the population at different times. They all have major problems in accommodating the basic facts that the early church proclaimed. Empty tomb, resurrected Messiah, transformed disciples. And I see these kinds of things as artifacts. They're kind of interesting, perhaps helpful, but the real issue always comes back to me, what about the witness of the earliest church? Is it trustworthy? Is what they're sharing with us worthy of our trust? Is their testimony to us today worthy of our confidence? They say that Jesus is alive in a real, tangible way. Should we believe them when they tell us this? Where do you find that witness of the earliest church? Where do you go to find the witness? I mean, Reverend Sledge, we had him on a video there. You can find enormous amounts of video for the Holocaust, but where do you go to find the witness of the earliest church? Where do you go? You go to the Bible. And you find out the witness of the earliest church. That's where their testimony is located. It's not in a video, it's in a book. And I guess the question is, do we trust them in their witness to us about Jesus? And it's the same kind of question we would ask about Reverend Sledge. Like him, do we trust the first disciples of Jesus to tell us the truth about him? We don't know them firsthand. We don't know what their character's like. On what basis do we offer confidence in their testimony to us? Now, I must tell you that I've thought about this quite a bit, and upon reflection, I do trust the witness of the earliest church about Jesus. I think they give us an accurate picture about his life, his death, and his resurrection. Why? Well, partly because based on their credentials. They were there. They were the first disciples. They saw everything firsthand in life and death and resurrection. They walked and moved with the Lord. And Jesus' disciples were everyday average sorts of people. They had no status. They had no claim to privilege. They weren't plugged into the political or military hierarchies of their day. And Jesus' first disciples lived out their lives as if the story they were telling was true. They told the story, and then they lived out their lives in conformity with the truth of the story that they were explaining to other people. Think about the implications of what they were saying to the world. Jesus, raised from the dead, Messiah, crucified, but now alive. The power of death defeated on the cross by the Lord. The victory of love over hatred. The good news of God's forgiveness for all. Do you believe their witness? Do you trust in what they're telling you today about the nature of God and about the reality of God's blessing and care for the world? This is what they testified to. And they lived this testimony out in their own lives. Their lives, as I say, were conformed to what they were saying. And that means a lot to me when there's a congruity between what they say and what they do. And we can see from the various letters in the New Testament, people who have conformed their lives to the witness they're sharing. And those first disciples of Jesus had no reason to deceive us. Why would they deceive us about something so important? They have no reason to lie or misinform us. Look at their own life circumstances. Almost all of them took the hard path. They took the hard way. They took the downwardly mobile life in their service of the message they were carrying out to the world. That's important to me. And they got no worldly blessing for what they shared to the world around them. We only have to look at Paul's vocation in bringing the good news of Jesus, once crucified but now raised from the dead, to the world. So what he says in the second letter to the Corinthian church, he says this: 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was pelted with stones. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day on the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false believers. I've labored and toiled and often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. This is the downwardly mobile life that Paul and other disciples who walked with him from the earliest church, they lived this out in their own experience. And as I say, they gained nothing in earthly terms for their service and devotion. Why did they do this? Because they say they met the risen Lord. That's why they did it. That's the underlying impulse for the missionary activity of that first generation of believers. They say they met the risen Lord. Do you believe them? They testify that Jesus is the Christ, the Lord, the Son of God, once crucified but now raised from the dead. Do you believe them? They give all people, including you and me, an incredible gift, the knowledge of the victory of God in Jesus Christ. This knowledge is also the reality of a beginning victory that God is still working out in our lives today. A victory over darkness and death, that even the hell of the Holocaust cannot ultimately overcome.